killed by the American government in what remains disputed circumstances. So Jeremy, you've read in on that today, obviously. Can you give me your first impressions of that and how that connects into the wider story that you've obviously looked at over the years?
Well, you know, what I thought was interesting about President Obama's public statement today was that he didn't use the word drone. You know, we're not engaged in a war. It's called a global contingency operation. And you know, it's a very Orwellian reality that is you know, sort of set in and has become our norm. But there have been 8 American citizens killed in drone strikes since 2002. The first drone strike outside of Afghanistan was in Yemen, and there were 6 people killed, one of whom was a U.S. citizen at the time. The Bush administration said that the American citizen was not the intended target of that strike, but nonetheless, Condoleezza Rice, who at the time was the National Security Advisor, defended the killing of American citizens, saying that it doesn't matter, that they can't hide behind their citizenship if they find themselves in these war zones. Needless to mention that Congress did not authorize a war against Yemen at the time. But the point I'm getting at is that of these 8 American citizens who we know have been killed, one of whom was a teenager who no one has alleged had any connections to terrorism outside of the fact that his father, Anwar al-Awlaki, was a famous propagandist that was known for his praising of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and calls for armed jihad. In only one case, does the U.S. government acknowledge that the American citizen they killed was the intended target, Anwar al-Awlaki? What that means is that there are 7 Americans who were killed when they weren't the intended target. So if you look at a 1-in-8 track record, and then you realize that the overwhelming majority of people killed are not American citizens, they're Pakistanis or Yemenis or Afghans, it makes you wonder how many thousands of those people were not the intended target. How many of them were actually posing an imminent threat to the United States? I bet that John Brennan, the CIA director, would be hard-pressed to show us evidence that they've killed almost anyone who actually was engaged in an imminent threat to the United States, which is the standard that Barack Obama says is used to authorize drone strikes.
The revelations today taught me 2 things. One, there has been a dilution from previous understandings that the president himself no longer signs off on each individual mission. I guess the sheer number of missions makes that impossible. And the second one was that there was no knowledge of who it was they were attacking when they attacked in the Afghanistan-Pakistan tribal region. But in the end, upon reflection, they concluded they had managed to kill an al-Qaeda leader, they said, who was an American, also 2 Western hostages, an American and an Italian. Were you surprised that they, in their attempt to show transparency, that they revealed as much as that, which I think actually raises more questions?
Well, you know, I mean, I would like to see an apology from President Obama for the countless innocent people who are not American citizens or Italian citizens that have been killed. I would like to see a lot more transparency in the aftermath of these operations. I mean, you know, because you run a news organization that has reporters in the line of fire and in dangerous areas, that the famous line from I.F. Stone is true: governments lie. And it's often the case that only when journalists or human rights organizations go to the scene of a drone strike is the official narrative challenged. You know, we're regularly told, oh, 8 suspected militants have been killed. What is a suspected militant? And since when is that the legal standard for the death penalty? You know, what the United States is basically doing is implementing a global death penalty that relies on pre-crime, like Minority Report, you know, Tom Cruise, where people who we think one day may pose a threat to us, we assert the right to kill those people. So, you know, I think that the drone program, like much of the national security apparatus, is shrouded in totally unjustifiable secrecy. And so while the White House did this today, I'm not so sure that they leaked it to the Wall Street Journal, and it definitely is a friendly paper when it comes to these issues. I think it's maybe that the Wall Street Journal reporter had gotten wind from someone in the counterterrorism community that was a source, and the White House wanted to get ahead of the story. So they acted as though they were going to be transparent on this. I don't know that they would have made this announcement. The fact that they killed an American citizen who was an aid worker and not affiliated with a terrorist organization put them in a unique position. But this administration claimed that it was going to be the most transparent in history, and in fact has secrecy policies that I think would make Richard Nixon blush.
President Obama said that he is responsible for every counterterrorism mission, and he accepts personal responsibility for this. But is it not an Achilles of the media that we amplify the message through the individual leadership? To your point about the terrorist national industrial sector, the decision makers seem to be belonging to a Byzantine web of different affiliated groups that are official or unofficial. Where do you begin as you investigate to figure out how much of this is even something the White House was aware of?
Well, you know, we have a tradition in the United States that when a politician achieves or wins the nomination of the Democratic or Republican Party, that they then have what's called a full access briefing from the director of the CIA. And so when then Senator Obama defeated Hillary Clinton and became the nominee, Michael Hayden, who was the CIA director at the time, flew to Chicago, where the Obama headquarters was, and he briefed Senator Obama in the federal building in Chicago on all of the national security threats facing the United States at home and abroad. And those briefings are designed to overwhelm these politicians who may end up being president, to overwhelm them with fear of another attack, particularly in the post-9/11 era, of another 9/11 style attack. And then once they come into office, or once they win the presidency, then you're briefed by a dozen and a half intelligence agencies, all of whom are singing the same tune. We need these authorities. We need you to expand this. Yes, I know on the campaign trail that you said you wanted to scale back U.S. military operations, but Mr. President, if you don't authorize us to start going into Yemen and hitting harder, the American homeland could be hit. It would take an extraordinary person, and we haven't seen that kind of a person in American political history, to actually stand up and say to all the generals, all the admirals, all the intelligence agencies, you know what, I want to hit the pause button on all of this lethal activity. And I want to actually understand the calculus of, is our counterterrorism program making us more safe or less safe? So when you start to investigate this, you can go down the largely meaningless rabbit hole of investigating the politicians. But what is more important, and I'm sure this is true in Canada as well, is to investigate the permanent national security bureaucracy, the people that aren't subjected to elections, the people that aren't really subjected to meaningful oversight, the people that at the end of the day can wait out any democratically elected official and then continue on with their game. And to me, that's the premier story in Canada and the US when it comes to these issues. It's not about Harper, it's not about Obama, it's about the people briefing them. It's about the people who are justifying their own budgets and their own existence and are engaged in, and I know there's legislation pending in Canada now that could have a great impact on civil liberties here, you know, focused on so-called lone wolf terrorists. These agencies have engaged in a massive power grab that in large part is a result of playing on the very real fears of a lot of ordinary folks in Canada and the United States that terrorists are going to come and get them. When in reality, it's a relatively minor threat compared to school shootings in the United States, and I'm sure there are equivalents here in Canada, although not the school shooting variety.
The challenge with, I suppose, that argument is that the individuals who are responsible for our safety will say that it's easy for journalists to make that case, to say the values of the permanent security establishments are not the same as most Canadians or most Americans, but we have a job to do to keep people safe. We need to have structures in place. We need bigger budgets because of that threat. What forum exists to better understand the challenges that all sides have? If you take the premise, a more benign approach, that people are trying their best to keep everyone safe, but the politics gets in the way and it becomes a fight and a tussle over money and over budgets.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, this, like, you know, we supposedly live in democratic societies. We don't have Tywin Lannister as the shadow, you know, power ruler of Canada or the United States. I mean, this ain't Game of Thrones, man. And if we want to hold our values and our system up as some sort of, you know, shining city on the hill and say to the rest of the world, this is how civilized democratic people organize themselves, then you have to actually mean to hold yourself to higher standards. I would, as a reporter who has spent time on the ground in Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, elsewhere, I would argue that we've hit a point, particularly in the post 9/11 world, where our stated counterterrorism program is actually encouraging terrorism. And I don't say that just from sitting on a couch somewhere. I think we're making more new enemies than we are killing actual terrorists. And those new enemies are not necessarily going to be terrorists. They're people with a legitimate score to settle. George Bush in the rubble of the World Trade Center went there and he said, the people that did this are going to hear from all of us. The tone was all about revenge. And that's the so-called leader of the free world getting up there and talking like a reckless cowboy who's somebody who's hitting on his girlfriend and he's just going to wrestle him up and take him down. And it's like, but you meet with people whose families family members were killed in night raids or drone strikes, and how can you look them in the eye and say, well, you know what, you actually don't have a right to plot an attack against a U.S. government entity. I mean, that's the world we're in right now, and it's people might attack me for saying that, but I think that our own counterterrorism officials are some of the leading breeders of terrorism right now.
One of your most personal moments, I think, in the documentary that connects with the book is the story of the Daoud family, Mohammed Daoud, who was a police commander in Afghanistan and was killed in a night raid that I think remains unclear as to what exactly was the intended purpose. Are you still in touch with that family? How are they doing now?
What was interesting is, I think that journalists by nature are thieves in a sense. We go and we take people's stories and then we run off and we tell those stories and they end up, people win prizes and they go on the front page of newspapers or magazines. And I've tried, and sometimes I succeed, sometimes I fail, to not be a thief in that sense, but to stay in touch with people in a remote part of Afghanistan and Somalia and Yemen is very difficult. And when our film came out, we really wanted to make sure that the people that had let us into their lives and trusted us knew that their story was being told, which was the only promise you can really make as a journalist, is we will tell your story. And so we made great efforts to make sure through our Afghan colleagues that we worked with that they all could see the film. And I didn't in a million years think we were going to get nominated for an Academy Award. And I was sitting in my pajamas on the couch watching the ceremony. I remember seeing a picture of Mohammed Daoud's family. That was the picture that they put up when they said we had been nominated for an award. And just tears were streaming down my face. Not because I was happy that we were being nominated for an Academy Award, because I couldn't believe that there was a human representation of people that had been killed in this night raid in a far-off part of Afghanistan, and to me it felt like in some way we had made good on our promise to tell their story. But that family is still suffering tremendously, and it is unclear why exactly they were killed. I've heard from U.S. soldiers, American soldiers, that knew Mohammed Daoud after our film came out, and they said, we saw your film and cannot believe that U.S. would allege that these people had any connection to the Taliban. This guy was alongside us fighting the Taliban. It's a challenge not to be a thief, but I try as hard as I can to stay in touch with the people that, particularly the people that took risks to make the Dirty Wars film possible.
Now, journalists are not just thieves. They also, when they get into difficult situations such as that, and you tell a personal story, sometimes stumble over the next part of what we call the string as you pull at it. And you saw in that, in the aftermath of the killing, where the U.S. soldiers had actually used a knife to remove the bullets, presumably to cover up some clues, there was subsequently a community meeting with a very senior ranking U.S. general.
Mm-hmm. Admiral.
Admiral. Yeah. Admiral McRaven.
Yeah.
So take it from there as you introduce both yourself and then the readers to this new entity, JSOC.
Yeah, I mean, JSOC actually has been around since 1980. It was formed in the sort of out of the ashes of the failed attempt by the U.S., this is when Jimmy Carter was president, to rescue the American hostages in the U.S. embassy in Tehran, Iran. And they tried a number of, it wasn't just Ben Affleck on a bicycle. They actually tried a number of sort of paramilitary and military operations, and they were sort of disastrous, and there was a lot of infighting among different military units. So the sort of dark ops folks at the Pentagon came up with this idea of creating an all-star team of the U.S. military that would draw from the elite ranks of what at the time was called Delta Force, U.S. Navy SEALs, very high-end helicopter pilots called the Night Stalkers. And they basically created a command that was not meant to ever be in the headlines, not meant to ever have a website or a Wikipedia page. And they largely existed in secret for several decades. And then as the Iraq and Afghanistan wars intensified and the kill, the so-called kill-capture campaign, you know, started to become the war, people like General Stanley McChrystal rose to prominence in the media. And at the time of the raid in Afghanistan, there had just been a switch in leadership of JSOC, and Joint Special Operations Command. And when this family was killed, and this the people who had the bullets dug out of them were pregnant women in front of their husbands who were zip-tied and about to be taken off to another province for interrogation, there was a huge protest in Gardez, in the city in Afghanistan. And so the U.S. military needed to figure out a way to quell what was a spreading sort of uprising. There have been a number of killings of prominent Afghan family members in a variety of areas, and there was this fear that it was going to boil over. And so this extraordinary scene plays out that actually was captured on camera by a great photographer for the Times of London named Jeremy Kelly, where these flatbed trucks pull up to this village where they've killed pregnant women and several other people and totally traumatized this family. And they have two sheep on the flatbed truck, and they offload the sheep and offer to sacrifice the sheep and ask for forgiveness for this raid. And most of the people there were Afghans, Afghan soldiers working with the U.S. But in one of the pictures that Jeremy Kelly took, we saw that there was a three-star U.S. military figure, and it said on his name tag, McRaven. And so we started researching him, and William McRaven was an original member of SEAL Team 6 and had spent his entire career in so-called dark ops, and was a much more sophisticated player in the world of black ops than Stanley McChrystal ever was or ever would be. And McChrystal was sort of born with a silver spoon in his mouth. McRaven was the real deal. And so once we started to look into his biography and who he was, we realized that this is the elite of the elite. And you as a journalist, you want to start from big questions and then drill down. You know, what is the commander of what is essentially the Praetorian Guard of the White House? What is his unit doing kicking down the door on a mid-level police commander in Afghanistan who is suspected of being with the Taliban?
Because he does answer to the White House directly.
Yeah.
Which comes back to that earlier question I had about how much Obama knows and how much of this is the permanent system in place. Mm. Do you think they were acting under orders?
Or was that particular raid?
Yeah.
No, I think what that's indicative of, now the primary way that people are killed in drone strikes is by intercepting data from cell phones or computers. At the beginning of the Iraq War, that wasn't the case. The Iraq invasion, they had to actually get human intelligence. And so what you saw was this radical expansion of night raids. And what they would do, they raid a place, they round up all of the military-aged men, they start to interrogate them, they look in their phones to see who they're in contact with. And this was all JSOC doing this under Stanley McChrystal, 2004, 2005 in Iraq. They started to build this big database. But they became addicted to this idea that each night raid will lead to the next night raid. And it became its own strategy. And so in Afghanistan, at this period, they were just starting to monitor the metadata on phones to do drone strikes, but they still were being powered by the previous night raid. So what I believe happened in this case is that there was a local political figure that had a score to settle with the Dawood family. And he sent multiple members of his family on different days to the U.S. military base in the area, and they said, you know, we've seen people making suicide vests in this compound. This person is actually a Taliban commander. This guy is an IED facilitator. So they build this narrative based on, you know, three family members of an opposing family, and that's enough to trigger a raid. So from the perspective of a tactical perspective of U.S. Special Operations Forces, they are trying to systematically go through and dismantle and kill all of the IED, improvised explosive device makers, the Taliban infrastructure in these areas. And so we've got three independent Afghan sources that are telling us that this is a Taliban compound. And this is a classic tactic that has played out in Afghanistan and in Iraq, where people will settle, you know, decades-old scores by convincing the Americans or the Brits that their neighbors are Taliban, when in reality they have nothing to do with the Taliban. And in this case, it was the exact opposite of being Taliban. It was a guy who had killed multiple members of the Taliban and been shot at repeatedly by the Taliban. So, I mean, it sort of shows the bankrupt nature of how the U.S. was waging, you know, this war in Afghanistan. But you're asking an interesting question about how much does Obama know. You know, I think Obama knows a lot. Obama is an incredibly sophisticated, intelligent leader who I think came into office in part on the notion that he wasn't like a cowboy like Bush. You know, he gave a very carefully crafted speech opposing the Iraq war in October 2002, before anyone knew who he was outside of Chicago, where he said, I don't oppose all wars, I oppose dumb wars. And if you really read that speech, he was articulating a fairly hawkish extension of Bill Clinton's foreign policy, but trying to put a spin of legitimacy and legality on it. Then he comes into office, and you know, he wanted to do healthcare, he wanted to do the economy, Afghanistan was his big priority. And basically, I think that, you know, people like Stanley McChrystal, David Petraeus, and William McRaven, along with the heads of the CIA, the NSA, others, basically pitched Obama this idea, you can outsource counterterrorism to JSOC and the CIA's paramilitary division, and you'll never have to put an American boot on the ground in Yemen or Somalia, and let us take it from here, Mr. President, you worry about the other things. People like Rahm Emanuel, who at the time was Obama's, you know, brain, you know, they used to call Karl Rove Bush's brain. Emanuel was Obama's brain when it came to strategizing politically about their policies. Rahm Emanuel's in all these briefings, and he's listening to the generals, the admirals, everyone else, and he's imagining what a one-term presidency would look like, you know, if there's another attack in the United States. So I think that the most cynical, kind of awful part of all of this at the beginning was that a large part of the reason why Obama so warmly embraced JSOC, the CIA's paramilitary division, is because of his political advisors' concern that if he didn't listen to them and something happened, he would never win a second term, which is not a good reason to you know, set policy.
You raise so many questions with that answer alone. One of them is sourcing. It's very interesting if one looks at the inconsistency, before I get to the sourcing, on the inconsistency of Obama's treatment, we've been working on a story at The Globe, which rolls tomorrow, which takes a very interesting look at a case involving three Manitoba students who all went missing in 2007. The intelligence briefing got to President Bush. We wrote about it first in 2010, the Lost Boys. And what we've now discovered is that one of those Lost Boys, the U.S. citizen, is in a Manhattan prison. Mm-hmm. He was one that the House Intelligence Committee debated whether they should kill him. And for whatever reason, the United States arrested him, which raises the question of whether the power of arrest is not available to them in more occasions than perhaps they use. The other two are Canadians. We believe them dead, and we believe them killed by drones. It raises the question, which we have not yet established, but raises the question of whether or not they were killed because they weren't U.S. citizens, and the U.S. citizenry actually offered a degree of protection. I don't ask for comment on that. It's a story that isn't in the public domain till the morning or later tonight on the website, but what I think it highlights is the level of complexity that we're entering into amid the various degrees of shadows and shades, that there is no monopoly of knowledge on all of this stuff. And the journalism is critical in order to emphasize and highlight some of the issues. That's more a comment from me. On the sourcing side of things...
Can I say something about this?
Please, yeah.
I mean, I'm very much looking forward to reading that piece, and I've been following this case as well. I mean, the question, there are a couple questions that I have about this, you know, from, I mean, obviously, I'm not, you know, fluent in Canadian politics or the Canadian intelligence apparatus. I would ask, if I were a journalist here in Canada, whether or not Canada had fed any intelligence on these on their own citizens into the various databases shared across the Five Eyes coalition, and whether or not that data was used to potentially track and ultimately kill citizens of Canada. But we also know that the United States has stated clearly that U.S. citizenship doesn't exempt you from being killed in a drone strike. There is a case where there was a British citizen of Somali origin who was killed in a U.S. drone strike, but he was killed after behind-the-scenes negotiations with the British government, and the British actually stripped him of his citizenship so that the Americans could kill him. And therefore, Britain wouldn't have to take up the question of whether or not they were complicit in the killing of one of their own citizens. There are lawsuits in Germany right now because the U.S. airbase at Ramstein plays a central role in the drone program, but also because Germany has shared data on its citizens with the United States, and there's a suspicion that some of that data has been used to track and kill German citizens. So, you know, Canada, I think, at times likes to have it both ways. They want to be in good with the Americans, and Canada has incredible eavesdropping capabilities and very sophisticated intelligence operations. And on the other hand, they want to be able to sort of say, well, we're not really engaged in this ultra-dirty stuff. The reality is Canada is one of the five nations that make up this ultra-powerful global surveillance and intelligence operation. And Canada is not a passive player in this. So, I mean, hopefully the reporting you guys are doing will also transition into Canadian officials having to answer questions about, if these people were killed, did the U.S. tell you that they were going to kill them? Did they tell you after they killed them? Did you provide any data on any of these people at any point? Because if they provided any data about their cell phones or their computers, those are the money shots for killing people in a drone strike. Way more valuable than human intelligence. Way more common than human intelligence. So, I mean, those are the questions I'd be asking, and I'm sure your journalists are asking them too. If my primary thing was reporting on the Canadian government.
Yeah, much of the work, obviously, that is done is source based.
Yeah.
Again, Obama, he's having a tough night, but Obama, he has, of course, we know now, prosecuted more journalists for breaking Secrets Acts than any other president, all other presidents combined. Mm. How oppressive is it for you in the United States to do your job when you're not overseas in Yemen or Somalia? Are you able to do your work unfettered?
Well, you know, I guess I have two ways of looking at that. One is, you know, I look at the incredible risks that journalists are facing around the world right now. And you know, record numbers of journalists are being killed in Syria and Somalia and Mexico and you know, Iraq. And the overwhelming majority of the journalists being killed are not, you know, famous white Westerners. They are largely Muslim journalists who are working either for wire services or stringing for, you know, Western news organizations so they can have that local flavor or that on-the-ground feel. And there's very little outcry when these journalists are killed. You know, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, two journalists that were beheaded by ISIS, the journalism community and I think the world reacted with horror and condemned those atrocious executions. But there's deafening silence when the unfamous non-white journalists are killed. And so, you know, and the reason I bring that up is because, you know, I think of the roadblocks that we encounter in the safety of Washington, D.C. or Toronto, you know, to doing our reporting. And I feel embarrassed that I even think about, you know, oh, this is a pain in the ass that I have to do this. My primary issue that I'm concerned about as a journalist reporting on national security stories, working with confidential sources, is protecting the source. And you know, Adam Goldman, who's a very good reporter for the Washington Post in the U.S., told a journalism rights organization recently that, you know, as journalists now doing this kind of reporting, we have to think like spies. But we're not spies, we're journalists. I mean, and if you think about that, we're encrypting our email, we're having spooky meetings in garages. Like, I mean, I as a kid watched All the President's Men, and then I actually have met with a source in a garage, and I felt like a jackass. But it's like, all right, well, the source said he wanted to meet in a garage. We can go meet in a garage. But it's like the only way to protect your sources is almost to become a Luddite. And you look at James Risen, who is an incredibly brave reporter and a great reporter. There was this campaign with threat of imprisonment for him to testify against his alleged source. And his alleged source, Jeffrey Sterling, was an African-American employee at the CIA who had previously filed a discrimination complaint against the CIA. And he's facing a couple of decades in prison for something that was a legitimate leak to a journalist that had actual meaningful news value and should have never been secret. David Petraeus today just received his sentence for leaking classified information, not to a journalist, but to a woman he was having sex with that wasn't his wife. And he gets a slap on the hand and a $100,000 fine. Jeffrey Sterling, potentially 20 years in prison. Chelsea Manning, 30 years in prison. Edward Snowden, threat of being prosecuted for treason and espionage if he comes back to the United States. David Petraeus, still an advisor to the CIA. It's incredible, the hypocrisy there. You can tell a lot about the U.S. Sort of position on whistleblowers versus official leaks, et cetera, by who is on book tour and who's in jail. Jose Rodriguez, who created the CIA black site torture program, he wrote a book that sounds like it's like some kind of Norwegian porn film. It's called Hard Measures. And in it, he says, that I know a lot of people, they think that what we did was torture, but some of us had to put on the big boy pants. That's what he called it, to go and torture people. This guy's on a book tour. Donald Rumsfeld is on a book tour. John Kiriakou, who spoke publicly about waterboarding, former CIA operative, just got done serving a federal prison stint. So you're right. Obama his administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act, which was implemented in 1917 officially to go after people that were collaborators with Germany. But in reality, it was to target dissidents and to be able to say that by opposing American war policy or opposing American security policy, that you are actively collaborating with the enemy. And so the public face of it was, this is to go after spies in our midst. But the intention of it was to go after dissidents. And that's essentially what's happening right now. The White House seems to want the only information that we get from government to be what they tell us in their background briefings or what they officially release. And that the number one goal of journalists, which should be to challenge the official line and fact check them, that's unacceptable. In fact, it might be criminal. That's very dangerous.
Do you find any hope? You're working with The Intercept, you're working with the Snowden documents. Do you find that more people come to you now, that there is a magnetism to the fact that you've put your head above the parapet, that you are prepared to ask these difficult questions? Or has there been a chilling effect that people who perhaps would have been predisposed to leaking material have decided this just is not worth it?
I think both things have happened. I had sources that when the Chelsea Manning case started unfolding and then, L'Affaire Snowden occurred, who said, I need to go dark for a while. But what we've noticed, especially when we implemented a secure way of leaking information or providing information to us, that I know now the Globe and Mail is also using the secure drop. I was talking with one of your great reporters, Colin Freese, last night, and we were discussing what percentage of the tips that we get through secure drop is just like absolute batshit crazy stuff. And Colin said with you guys it's about 95%. I was putting it with us at about 75%, which means that we've gotten 25% of the communications we've gotten actually are interesting. Now, they're not always people with access to classified documents. In some cases, it's someone who has worked in intelligence, and they say, hey, I saw this story. You should, why don't you look in your Snowden archive for these terms? We've gotten a lot of stories that way. We've gotten new sources that way. Glenn Greenwald always talks about courage is contagious. We definitely are seeing evidence of that. But the onus is on the journalist to protect the sources, and that's the real challenge. I mean, everyone... all media outlets should be using what the Globe and Mail is using right now, secure drop. Nothing is foolproof in our surveillance society. Yeah. But it's the equivalent of like you know, are you going to run around to brothels without condoms? Never mind. Yeah.
Discuss.
Safe digital sex for the leaker. Did you think we were going to be talking about unprotected sex tonight?
Yeah. A Norwegian porn.
A Norwegian porn. Yeah. Sorry.
The state of the media generally, you know, many people will dismiss yourself and my own interest in this topic as nerds. Yeah, sure, it's important, but you're just trying to get attention. There isn't really that much that we need to worry about. You're just, you know, you're causing problems. It is for sure, to Natalie's opening statement, the quality of journalism is diminished because of the economic disruptions. You need strong ownership. You need to have a sense of the direction you're going. You need a strategy. The Globe's lucky in that way. I think we have tremendous ownership. But for yourself in the United States, where you're dealing with a tremendous change and a lot of disruption, and you've had this leading story of the Snowden documents, and you've obviously got global access to that, how are you finding the state of the media generally, and how do you find the work of The Intercept is working as a business model? Because you have to make money.
Well, as a business model, we are absolute failures. We have never made a penny and probably never will. And I mean, I can share with you. I'm not, maybe this is boring to people, so I'll try to limit it. But you know, part of what happened, we went through a period where Glenn and Laura Poitras and myself, we were wondering whether or not the whole thing was going to fold. You know, we had started off with what we thought was going to be, you know, an omnibus site that was going to cover everything, and that was sort of our understanding. And then, you know, we have a sole funder, Pierre Omidyar, who was you know, one of the founders of eBay and a, you know, the 100th something richest man in the world. He's worth like $9 billion or something. You know, odd person for Glenn and myself to be sitting across from. And we went through a process where it seemed at times like it just was going to fold. It wasn't going to work, or we weren't going to be able to have any meaningful independence. And it wasn't because, you know, Pierre Omidyar is some you know, sort of evil control freak. Not at all. But he is a business person, mm-hmm. and he has people that are sort of anarchists coming at him and saying, "Yes, we want to take your money, but we don't ever want to see you in an editorial meeting. We don't want to get any phone calls from you about any of the articles that we publish. But if the government sues us, we definitely want you to defend us and pay for our defense." You know, and so who would have thought that would cause problems? But what ended up happening is we engaged in negotiations, and we were able to come to agreement where we have full editorial autonomy, a knowable budget, and full authority to hire whoever we want without Pierre signing off on it. And we have, you know, we have a commitment, and you know, it's funny to hear a billionaire say this. He said, "I don't have any expectation that you're going to be generating any revenue. I just want you to do the journalism that you've told me you want to do." And particularly over the past 3 months, we have a new editor-in-chief, Betsy Reed, who's fantastic. That's borne out. You know, I've only heard, the only thing I ever hear from Pierre Omidyar is, "Oh, nice job on that article." We don't ever hear anything from him anymore, and he made good on his commitment. Now, we're in a totally privileged position in the sense that we have funding. We're building something from the ground up. We've had all sorts of growing pains. We've made all sorts of mistakes. But I think that, you know, if we fast forward to a year from now, The Intercept will be known for doing a narrow number of things really well. And I think that focusing in on certain key issues, stories, beats, and really reporting the hell out of them will be our place on the journalism landscape.
So will you take documents such as the Snowden collection, and that will inspire you to travel? Or will you de-link yourself from Snowden entirely and go to where the news is?
We're not going to de-link ourselves from Snowden at all. You know, one thing that's kind of fascinating, you know, I generally haven't worked on the Snowden stories. I recently started to do some of them, but that was more Glenn and other people that were working on those. And there were all sorts of limitations because of the way that we were protecting the documents. It was really hard to get a lot of people searching those documents. And we've been working more and more on that. But what I, you know, when I actually started doing searches in the Snowden archive, I'm astonished at how many stories are unreported right now. You know, the Washington Post only had a small fraction of the documents. The Guardian only had a small fraction of the documents. The New York Times has a tiny fraction. ProPublica has a small fraction. There are thousands of stories to report there that have great meaning to our lives. The challenge is we have great responsibility because we have the whole archive. So we are moving toward developing aggressive partnerships with a variety of journalists around the world and to try to get as much of the Snowden archive reported as possible over the course of the next 2 years. But I mean, I'm much more interested in pursuing leads that come in from other sources. You know, this, we have the Snowden archive in place and we want to report it thoroughly. But there are so many other fascinating components to the national security state. The NSA is just part of it. And most of those documents are NSA or GCHQ documents. The CIA, the US military, a lot of those documents don't pertain to them. That's what I'm interested in.
When you were dealing with the book, you traveled to quite a number of countries. What was the most difficult story that you were able to convey of all of the challenging ones? Because it isn't a happy read.
Well, the most difficult story was one that I couldn't figure out how to convey. We were in Mogadishu, in Somalia, and we were at a cot cafe, you know, where people chew cot. By the way, I love cot. It's my favorite drug I've ever had. I don't know if you're into drugs you've been in your life, but like cot is amazing, and it's I'm going to digress for a second, but I assure you it's worth it. So there's like three stages to chewing cot, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, you have a chaw in your mouth, but like, you know, Yemenis are like, you know, like true Yemeni cot chewers have like, you know, massive, cheeks. Like I cannot believe
squirrel
how
cheek.
Much yeah. they can get in there. It's like amazing. It's like a small Death Star is in their mouth. Oh, bam. And when I was in Somalia, I was chewing cot, but never really got into it. And then in Yemen, I got baptized in cot, which means that you have to actually cut the inside of your jaw with the leaf in order for it to start getting into your bloodstream, and then you really experience cot. And so once I cut up my jaw, you know, internally and started to feel the effects of cot, I realized how kind of central it is to reporting in both Somalia and Yemen. Because, you know, and because America, the United States has such ridiculous policies about drugs, we're like the only government in Yemen whose diplomats were banned from chewing cot. So it meant that no one would ever tell the Americans anything because everything gets done at a cot chew. So it's like, you know, it's like you're the jackass not chewing cot, get him out of here. You know, it's like, you know, CIA guys cannot know anything in Yemen on the ground because they're not allowed to chew cot, poor guys. But there are three stages when you're chewing cot. And the first one is sort of like you're like the parakeet. You know, you're just talking a mile a minute, and you know you have the best story that you're going to tell everybody, and you're just going on and on and on. And then you transition into the lion, where you're just just chilling. You know, you're listening to everybody else in their parakeet phase, and then you hit the donkey, the jackass phase, where you're just clowning and oh my god, I had some agreement made with some Yemeni tribal sheikh to start exporting cars to Yemen at the end of a cot chew. And I was like, woke up the next morning and I'm looking at my notebook and I'm like, we especially want Honda Civics? I'm like, what the hell is a Honda Civic? What is this talking about? But no, the thing is, like, I was trying to figure out why, like, no one would do interviews with us in Yemen, and it was because they were all at cot chews. So once you start going to the cot chews, then everybody will do an interview with you, especially if you catch them in the jackass phase, and you're really lucky. I was at a cot chew once where Ali Abdullah Saleh, you know, the former dictator of Yemen, who still is actually in power, I was supposed to be meeting with him and some of his advisors, and so I went to the deputy foreign minister's house, and we're sitting there. And this like gendarmerie arrives with all of these bags with the presidential seal of Yemen on them. And it was cot from Ali Abdullah Saleh. He never showed up, but he sent the official cot of the presidency in Yemen so that we could chew it with his advisors. On a not so light high note, we were in Mogadishu and we were at a cafe where people were chewing cot and drinking tea, and at this time, Mogadishu, Al-Shabaab was still in control. This was in the summer of 2011. Al-Shabaab was still in control of a large part of the Bakara market, which is sort of the center of Mogadishu, and there was a lot of fighting going on between U.S.-backed African Union forces, al-Shabaab, and then certain clan-based militias. So it was a very dangerous atmosphere. And Mohammed Fazul, who was the head of al-Qaeda in East Africa, had just been killed at a checkpoint by a Sufi militia. And which is kind of ironic. I mean, Sufi and militia should not be said next to each other, but this is part of what's happened in Somalia, is that the U.S. And Ethiopia and its allies have started to basically fund anyone that they believe could fight al-Qaeda. And so these militias, you know, are forming using child soldiers that are Quranic students, that are learning to memorize the Quran. And instead of having them just go through this rote memorization, they're starting to train them militarily. And it's sad to see what's happening with so many kids there. But we're in this cafe, and our Somali colleague, Bashir, said, you know, I think we've been here too long, we should leave. So we get into our vehicle, and we start making our way to another part of town, and we hear this massive explosion. And there had been an IED set off right across the street from that cafe, and it hit a bus stop where there was a minivan full of students from the University of Mogadishu who were, you know, waiting on the bus stop, and the IED had just missed a convoy of Burundian soldiers, but it blew up this van full of university students. And we were traveling with a local reporter at the time who worked for Agence France-Presse. And so he's like a, you know, he's a beat crime reporter basically, but in a war zone. And we went with him to the central morgue in Mogadishu and the hospital. And, you know, we saw all of these students that had survived, who were missing limbs, that had shrapnel embedded in their faces. And they were coming up to us holding bloodied ID cards saying, have you seen my friend? Have you seen this person here? And they're asking us as journalists, because we were moving around the hospital. And this one guy insisted that we take this ID card and try to find this kid, a friend of his. And he has shrapnel all over his face, completely covered in blood. But he's just saying, do you know where my friend is? And so we go down to the morgue, and the AFP reporter was doing the who, what, where, when, why, and was just trying to get a count of the dead and what are their names and how many. And we're in this morgue, and there were three bodies on tables. There's no air conditioning at all, and it's sweltering hot, and there's flies everywhere. This university student whose ID we had was laying on the table. And he looked totally peaceful and serene, and his eyes were closed, and his body didn't have any shrapnel or anything, and he just had a huge hole in his face where you could see the bottom of the table through it. So some projectile had come through and killed him, but it was like a clean shot. And then another body was, the head was completely blown off, except for the nose, part of the mouth, and the neck. So the head was just gone, and it was this, you know, another student. And we're in this morgue, and then the morticians, who get paid, I think they get paid something, a few dollars per body when they take care of them, and their business is very good in Mogadishu, unfortunately. While we're in there, family members of students start to arrive at the hospital grounds. And they make their way to the morgue, and the mortician shuts the door, and he says to our Somali colleagues, you know, I'm afraid that if they see white people in here, they're going to think you had something to do with it, that maybe you're CIA, maybe this was some kind of a plot, maybe you did this. And the people are outside, they're banging on the door, and they're demanding to come in. And the morticians also said, you know, we also don't want to show them, particularly this man with his head blown off, because there is, you know, the violence could happen as a result of this. We need to be able to wrap it in something. So we were stuck there for about an hour inside of this morgue. And for days after that, I couldn't escape the sensation that I had flesh on my tongue, because the morticians were hosing down the bodies because there was, you know, it's hot, and they were just trying to keep them cool so that they, you know, they didn't start immediately to rot. And I tried to write about that in the book. I tried to describe what it was like to have been sitting somewhere, and then only by chance you move, and then it gets blown up, and then these students that have nothing to do with it, that are trying their best to be students in a war zone, like, why did they have to die that day? It's totally senseless. It made absolutely no sense, but I couldn't find the words to write it, and I couldn't figure out what it was I wanted to say. But it stuck with me for, it sticks with me to this day. And I know you know this too. As a journalist, you, if those stories don't haunt you at night, mm-hmm. if you don't have the faces of people who have let you into their lives or let you into their loved ones' deaths, then you probably should stop being a journalist. If you stop having human emotion and reaction, you stop caring, or you stop thinking that objectivity is total bullshit, like that sometimes the truth is just true, then it's probably time for you to step back and go do something else.
Yes, very well put. Very well put. Jeremy, that ends the conversation between us. It's very important, though, that everyone feels that they can connect. There's a microphone over to my right on the left-hand side. If anyone would like to line up and ask questions, we'll moderate that. If we can keep it short questions, say your name and organization if that is pertinent, and make sure it's a question, not a statement. We'll get through as many people as we possibly can. And we've got 30 minutes, so we've got until 8:30 Eastern. Thank you.
Hi, Salim Khan, InvestigateNet. I'm curious, we just saw some of the Blackwater mercenaries convicted just a little while ago, not too long ago. And I'm curious about your perspective on what that might mean, if anything, for other incidents that involve Blackwater. I think something like 80% of the incidents they were involved in, they shot first. So I'm curious about what you, whether there's anything to be taken away from that. Mm.
Just by way of background for people that may not have been following the story as closely as you are. In September of 2007, a group of Blackwater contractors who were working for the U.S. State Department and the CIA in Iraq opened fire on a very crowded intersection in the middle of the day, and they killed 16 Iraqis, including a 9-year-old boy. And they said that they had come under fire, that has not been proven, and it seems like it's a complete lie that they had come under fire. But the point was that they were driving down the wrong side of the wrong direction on a one-way road. An Iraqi car didn't stop fast enough. They fired a projectile at it. It blew up the car, and then that opened a period of 10 minutes or so of just sustained automatic gunfire, at the end of which there were 16 Iraqis killed and scores of others wounded. And through a very complicated process and a lot of internal manipulations by this U.S. State Department to try to stop them from being prosecuted, the U.S. Justice Department actually went ahead and indicted four of these guys. A fifth guy pled guilty and then agreed to testify against his former colleagues. So they were convicted by a jury in the United States of, in one case, murder, and then in other cases, manslaughter. And several of them are receiving multi-decade-long sentences and probably will never see the light of day. And another guy is sentenced to life in prison. This is being portrayed as holding Blackwater accountable. But the reality is those guys weren't there in a vacuum. They were sent there by people who didn't value Muslim or Arab lives. And I'm not saying that in a rhetorical way. Eric Prince and other people that ran Blackwater created an environment that encouraged the killing of people because they were Muslim or because they were Iraqis. And they would go night hunting with night vision goggles and gun people down. They would shoot people for sport. They were using steroids and other drugs, and they were riding around just shooting people. The fact that these guys got prosecuted is justice in some sense. They did the actual shooting of these actual Iraqis, and they killed them. But what about the people at the top? You know, you look at who goes down for Abu Ghraib. It's, you know, Lindy England, a barely literate person from one of the poorest regions in the United States. Lindy England was the mastermind of our torture program at Abu Ghraib? No. His name is first name Donald, last name Rumsfeld. And where is he? On book tour. Real justice will be when we live in a society, as we do in the United States, where our Supreme Court says that corporations have the same rights as people, when a corporation like Blackwater gets the death penalty. I'm against the death penalty for people, but totally supportive of it for corporations that kill people.
So if I could just follow up, do you think that these convictions have any sort of long-term potential for further legal action?
No, I think it was the token case. I also think that there were certain prosecutors that just didn't want to drop it in the U.S., and I give them credit for that. Like I think they really wanted to see justice. I think there are several survivors of that massacre who are really amazing, compelling people. One of the guys the guy whose son was killed, Mohammed Kanani, I know him personally and did some stories on him. We did a short film about Mohammed Kanani. And you know, his story is extraordinary for all sorts of reasons. He watched his son die in this massacre and desperately tried to save him. But when the U.S. came and said, we want to give you a condolence payment, you know, which I think was $5,000 or $10,000 for your son, he said that he wanted the money instead to be donated to the family of an American soldier who had been killed in Iraq. I mean, I disagree with Mohammed Kanani's politics on the Iraq invasion. He supported it at the beginning. But this is a guy whose 9-year-old son was shot in the head, and he privately, not publicly, doesn't hold a press conference, privately says to the United States government, no, I want you to take that money and give it to the family of an American soldier who was killed in Iraq. How can you, as a prosecutor in the United States, when you look at that kind of a story and you get invested in who his son was, you know, to walk away from it would be tough. And I really do think part of it was a human component, and part of it was they needed to be able to say they did something to Blackwater at the end of the day. So they take the guys lowest down on the pole. You know, guys who had done one term in the military, you know, not the elite of the elite, and they let them go to jail for life. And we can say, oh, Blackwater, we took care of that case. So no, I don't think it has any real meaningful implications going forward. They now make private security companies, in order to get a contract from the U.S. government, you have to voluntarily sign some code of conduct that is totally meaningless. It's just a piece of paper. So no, I think it's good. We're going to continue to see these kinds of things happen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Next questioner, please.
First of all, thanks for coming, Jeremy. Really appreciate that. My name is Basil. I'm a Muslim youth coordinator here for this a community center here in Toronto, and really started to take an interest in politics and whatnot in your work. When I was denied entry into the U.S. last year, I used to go to the U.S. all the time, have my family there, and my lawyer and I tried to figure out what happened. No answer whatsoever, but we're still working on it. I'm still optimistic. But I kind of wanted to ask you, what's been said about books, videos, theories out there, and the fact that the media does not humanize an Iraqi civilian the way it does a Western civilian? I've always tried to understand that. And I remember watching one of your video clips about how you said that if we humanize civilians in the same way we did the Virginia Tech civilians, you know, this war would end tomorrow, to something to that extent. And I just wanted to know more about that in particular, because I think that the American people are amazing people. They're very resilient, and you're one of them, right? And so if they knew what was happening, if the knowledge was out there, but I really want to know with the media, the corporate media, how is it that it gets away with you know, we killing a million Iraqis and not it being mentioned at all?
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And the fact that you're being denied entry to the United States is, I mean, there's major litigation right now based on the no-fly list, and a lot of the plaintiffs in these cases, and they are actually winning some of their legal cases, are of course Muslims or Arab Americans. And we published, much to the government's anger, the 170-page rule book that the U.S. government uses for watchlisting people. We published it in its entirety, and we got it from a whistleblower, and that initiated some litigation against the government based on the idea that we, even as American citizens, are not allowed to know whether or not we're on the watch list, and if we are, why we're on the watch list. So that's being challenged. But one of the things that we discovered in these secret slides that we got along with the watch list manual was that the number two city in the United States where people that are on the terror watch list reside is Dearborn, Michigan, population 96,000. And the other cities were all huge American cities, New York, Houston, San Diego, Chicago, and then little Dearborn, Michigan. Why? It has the greatest percentage of Muslim Americans and Arab Americans per capita of any city in the United States, and that's why it's being targeted. It's abundantly clear. I mean, you can't look at that and come to any other conclusion. The only act of terrorism that has ever been knowingly plotted from Dearborn, Michigan, was a white Vietnam War vet who tried to blow up the largest mosque in the United States. You know, so I mean, so you're, the situation you're in, you could be on that list because of one uncorroborated Facebook post or tweet. That's what our reporting showed. You could be on that list because your number was found in the phone of someone and your name is similar to someone else's. They can put dead people on the terror watch list. They actually justify it by saying, well, maybe terrorists want to use Osama bin Laden's name as their nom de guerre. And what? Get on a plane saying, my name is Osama bin Laden? Like, I mean, these are our best and brightest intelligence operatives. So, I mean, I hear you, and I think that that's, and you know, your lawyer should look at the recent litigation. This is a very hardcore, serious issue of racial and religious profiling that's happening. As to the Iraq story, I mean, just in short, I don't think that the war would end tomorrow, because I think Islamophobia is on the rise. I think that there is a very effective fear machinery at play, that manifests itself both in media and in the statements of politicians. But I do think that Muslims and Arabs and Pakistanis and Afghans and increasingly Somalis are being dehumanized in a systematic way. And the so-called lone wolf terrorism problem, which I know you're dealing with in Canada, and there's a lot of debate about this, it's as though if you put the word, you know, Muslim or Islamic next to any sort of other identifying characteristics of a gunman or something else, it's like it catapults into this other category. You know, I mean, we should be profiling deranged white dudes who play video games in their parents' basement who then go and shoot up schools in our country. It's not that there's not a problem. It's not that some people that there are not Islamic radicals who believe that what they're doing is going to result in them going to paradise. That exists. But that doesn't even rank in the top 10 problems we face in our societies in terms of violence. And I think that, like, the media is at its best when tragedies like the school shootings happen or the Charlie Hebdo massacre happens, because the victims become human beings to us. We knew about the teacher who threw herself in front of the door to protect her students from being killed. We knew the name of the little boy who was killed in the Boston Marathon bombing, and his name has been repeated over and over during the Jahar Tsarnaev trial and sentencing. And it's great journalism, and it's journalism that makes you care about the story. You know, our challenge is, how do we replicate that same sense of empathy or concern or care for people who live on the other side of the missiles a world away? It's what David's reporters are trying to do right now. It's what we try to do. That should be the real challenge of journalists. I don't give a flying fuck about the real housewives of Jersey, but I do care about the real widows of Baghdad. And yet we don't ever hear those stories unless journalists go there and tell them. So I don't think that the war would end, but I think it would force a debate that we're not really having and that people feel isn't really their problem.
Yeah. Next question, please.
Hey, I read an article in Der Spiegel. I'm not sure if you saw this, about Haji Bakr,
yeah.
And they found his sort of blueprints for mm-hmm. the Islamic State, and they were pretty secular blueprints mm-hmm. Compared to a lot of the rhetoric about it. And I'm just wondering, given what you know about this situation, how much of this expansion has been driven by the kind of religious ideology that is mostly talked about by politicians, and how much is just sort of standard sociopaths who want more power? And in any case, how the efforts of the United States and Canada to degrade the Islamic State, how likely do you think they are to succeed?
First of all, the report that you're citing is from a reporter named Christoph Reuter, who has a new book out that's just come out in Germany, and he spent a great deal of time in areas that were controlled by the Islamic State and got these primary source documents. About 6 or 8 months ago, I was on Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now! In the U.S., and I was talking about this same issue. I spent a lot of time in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was president, and I know, I knew, and I talked about this 6, 8 months ago, that one of the top military commanders of ISIS was a guy named Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri al-Tikriti. And Izzat Ibrahim was the king of clubs on the U.S. Card deck. And he was a secular Ba'athist who was one of Saddam's top military figures, with a sort of storied career in the Iraqi military, including working with the United States in the 1980s when the U.S. was feeding intelligence to both Iraq and Iran to try to get them to, in the words of Kissinger, kill each other off. The core, the military core of ISIS is largely made up of former members of Saddam Hussein's military. And the documents that Der Spiegel published showed that they came up with this idea of structuring an insurgent force and putting as a political figurehead of the organization this guy who was a nobody, Baghdadi, and say, well, he can be the caliph, you know, the head of the caliphate. And they say in the documents that part of the aim was to encourage non-tribal international support for what was essentially the same war that the Ba'athists were fighting from the moment American tanks rolled into Iraq. So you know, the story of that ISIS, it's the caliphate, chopping off heads, radical Sharia law, like all of that is true to an extent and with a certain part of the organization. But that's not as interesting as who's really running ISIS. And where is ISIS getting its weaponry? The people running ISIS were largely the military people, Saddam-era military. The weapons that they have largely been seized from the U.S. supplies left behind for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi government. So to just make this about Islam or radical Islam or you know savages or people that want to live in the 13th century, I mean, that is so missing the actual point here. I mean, this is, in a way, blowback. And so in order to sort of fight this, you can approach it from the perspective that you're in war against radical Islam, which is the dominant theory right now in the West, or you can say, how do we negotiate with the people that are actually in charge that mostly are fighting to retake land that they had when Saddam was president? That's the biggest motivating factor in large parts of Iraq. I'm not trying to discount the radical militant elements there, but they've largely been attracted to it so that they can die as fodder for a war that is largely about tribal control of certain areas of Syria and certain areas of Iraq. So I don't know if that makes sense. I don't want to understate how atrocious the beheading is and some of that stuff, but I also think that we're missing a huge part of this story, and in doing so, we're lessening our ability to negotiate with who's actually in power, if we even want to negotiate. I don't see a military solution to what's happening, because I think you would have to kill off every single local person from certain areas of Iraq and Syria. They are ultimately fighting the same war they've always been fighting. Thank you for your question.
Thank you. I've got a question from the Twitter sphere. Steve Nixon, what in your view was the political motivation behind the recent march by world leaders in Paris? It would have been after Charlie Hebdo. And well, I suppose the absence of Obama.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't read too much into the Obama absence. I mean, I'm a very tough critic of Obama, but I don't think that he was snubbing it because he's a secret Muslim, which actually was said on American television that's why, because he supports radical Islam. He also is somehow a communist. He's a Mau Mau, a communist, a socialist, a black nationalist, and an Al Qaeda sympathizer, and a Nobel Peace Prize winner, all wrapped in one. Look, I mean, maybe this is cynical, but I think it's true. I called it a circus of hypocrisy. You look at all of these world leaders from Benjamin Netanyahu to Angela Merkel, and everyone in between, and almost all of those leaders, in some way or another, are waging a war against a free press in their own country. I like everyone, I was utterly horrified at what happened at Charlie Hebdo, and I am a free speech absolutist. I mean, I believe in free speech for despicable white supremacists in the United States. I also believe in the right of people to respond to it in whatever way they feel appropriate, but I think they have a right to their free speech. But I think that those world leaders were, they're jumping on a bandwagon. And in a way, I felt like they were kind of parading on the graves of the media workers that were killed. I thought that the indigenous outpouring of support from a lot of people was really moving, but those leaders, nah, I don't know. Those are plastic, figurines. But I will say, and this is disturbing, and it's a complicated issue to talk about. The backlash and then the targeting of Muslims in the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo massacre is a story that I think has been underreported. France was attempting to criminalize people that tweeted with the hashtag, I am not Charlie Hebdo, and that's part of the danger here, is that when Western societies get hit in these ways, the immediate instinct is to sort of lock everything down. We and intelligence agencies are waiting. Milton Friedman used to talk about that history is changed by the ideas that are lying around when a crisis happens, and the think tankers have a lot of ideas lying around. And Naomi Klein calls people at think tanks the people paid to think by the makers of tanks, which I think is an awesome phrase. But that's I'm very concerned with this. There's a disproportionate balance between security and privacy in our society, and that's not an accident. And it's not just like a bunch of dumb lawmakers accidentally voted for something. Like, there are financial and political interests here that are at play as part of the parallel national security state.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Hi, I'm Tanara Yelland, and I work with Vice here in Toronto. You mentioned that there's an ongoing story here in Canada of lone wolf terrorists often being arrested by the RCMP before they've done anything. So we really only have the RCMP's say to go on. And there's also a lot of coverage of extremists traveling from Canada to fight with ISIS. And I'm wondering what you think is a responsible way for journalists who cover that kind of thing to balance the news value of those arrests and those defections with the need to not sort of legitimize what seems to be a political agenda,
yeah,
if there is one?
A couple of things. First of all, I think that I'm not so familiar with the RCMP's targeting of potential cells or individuals that are engaging in these plots, but I am very familiar with, in our country, with the FBI. And I like to say the FBI has a PhD in breaking up its own terror plots. And if you look at some of the most high-profile, busts of would-be terrorists who were on the verge of blowing up a Jewish community center or a bridge or something, and you just peel back the layers a little bit, you realize that the plot wouldn't have happened without the FBI. And in many cases, they are going after people who are, either mentally ill or mentally challenged. And they try to encourage them to cross state lines to buy a weapon and then bring it back, because then they can really pile on the charges against them. It makes it a conspiracy. It makes it terrorism versus just a regular run-of-the-mill crime. And I think that as journalists, we have an obligation to be extremely skeptical when our intelligence and law enforcement agencies claim to have broken up a terror plot. Their track record is too dirty in the United States in particular, but I'm sure there's some of this in Canada too. I just am not following it that closely. But no journalist I respect ever believes the first press release of an FBI of the FBI about these terror busts. And almost always there's some bullshit sitting in it. So I would just say, like with everything, you should, obviously be very skeptical. The other thing, and this may be, I may get pushback on this, but I think it's true, so I'll say it. I think that we should be examining how it is that young people from, scores of young people from Canada have traveled to either Somalia or areas controlled by ISIS in an effort to join up with the group. The same is true in the United States. I see a lot of those young people more the way that I see, the Columbine shooters than I do Osama bin Laden. I think that they're falling, and they're struggling with their identity, and they're at a vulnerable stage in their lives. Who catches them when they're falling? I mean, this is true of a lot of young people in general in society. It's true of the kids who shoot up schools. It's true of the Somalis from Minnesota who want to go to join Al-Shabaab. They're not born wired with some, perverted version of Islam that's going to motivate them to go and blow themselves up at the gates of the African Union Peacekeeping Force compound. Something is happening there that on a human level. And I think we should be focusing on looking at the similarities among a lot of particularly the young people that are going over there, and try to address how it is that there are systematic failures that lead to them wanting to go over there. I mean, that to me is a more common sense approach. than saying, you know, we need to be targeting the mosques, we need to get informants and snitches in all these places. Because at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to be as effective. So, I think we just need to kind of take a deep breath, look at this in terms of its scale, scope, actual threat, and then study individual cases. Why did this young person go off to do this? Like, well, you guys are reporting on the Winnipeg Three. What motivated them? Why did they want to go and do that? What was happening in their lives? To me, that's much more interesting than just, well, they heard Anwar al-Awlaki one day, and next thing you know, they're just blowing themselves up. I mean, it's just bullshit. That's not how the human mind works.
I think we've got time for two more questions, briefly, if you'd like to come to the mic.
I'm Cody. I go to U of T. You briefly mentioned how when President Obama was elected, different security advisors approached him and essentially kind of said, like, we need the funding and, like, we need you to authorize all these things. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if there's any ideas you have about, like, there is the upcoming American election, and of course there will be a new president. If there's a way that you can mitigate, like, those effects from those, like, advisors.
I mean, that's the $64,000 question. I believe that we should have a requirement in the United States that anyone who gets elected to any position in Congress or the White House should have to wear like a NASCAR outfit with the logos of all of the companies that funded their campaign. I think it would be amazing transparency. I would like to see that in Canada too, where you could just, you know, it's like, hey, here's Lockheed Martin over here, and we got Boeing, Big Pharma. But corporations are totally in control of our political system in the United States. In some countries, you take suitcases full of cash and bribe the politicians. In the United States, we just call it campaign finance. And so our entire system is built on the idea that those with the most money are going to have the most influence over politicians. And those with the most money are generally large corporations that bundle their funding together, and they make it so that anyone who's going to win will have an incentive to support the manufacturer of the weapons that they make, or to ensure that their drugs make it to market even if they haven't fully been tested. I mean, that's the real scandal. So I'm trying to answer you in a blunt way. There is no way that this ever changes in any meaningful way. It's not going to be that we have this one amazing president that changes it all, unless we address the incredible influence of corporations over our political process. It is totally contaminating the notion or principle of democratic process in the United States. And I think increasingly in Canada, things are being privatized also with the way that campaigns are run. So this isn't just the U.S., it's across the board.
Okay, last question. Anyone got a last question they want to squeeze in?
Hi, Jeremy. My name is Colin. I work for a PR agency here called Maverick. And you've obviously worked
what
on
some... What are you
some...
telling me?
What's that? you've obviously been doing some really controversial reporting over the years, putting out some stories on really powerful people, Eric Prince, Blackwater, government agencies, that some people obviously would not like to see published. So I was wondering if you've experienced or could tell us a little bit about any attempts to suppress a story that you've been working on.
I mean, I get it. I mean, I understand why you're asking that question. I mean, I get embarrassed whenever that's brought up, just because, you know, I know journalists. I was counting recently. I know 13 journalists personally that were killed since 9/11, and you know, I mean, I certainly have received threats. I certainly have been stonewalled. I'm not allowed to go to certain press conferences. Government is trying to figure out sources for stories that I'm doing, but you know, at the end of the day, I get embarrassed because I think of, like, you know, James Foley had his head chopped off. You know, Abdulella Haider Shaya, Yemeni journalist, was put in prison because he exposed a U.S. missile strike that the U.S. was trying to blame on the Yemeni government. You know, journalists are being gunned down in Somalia for writing pieces about powerful people. All journalists that are going at the heart of power face challenges. And I'm not, you know, I'm certainly no different than anyone else. But I wish that we would focus not on, you know, someone who's invited to speak in front of this prestigious group with the editor-in-chief of a major newspaper. I wish we would focus on the unfamous, unknown journalists who are in the real line of fire. So I guess I'll use my minute to answer your question, to say that I want people to look into the cases of other journalists, particularly non-white Western journalists who are being killed.
That's a great way to end it for now, Jeremy. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We've been treated to an absolutely superb hour and a half of discussion and some stories of cut madness. On behalf of the entire audience, I would like to thank Jeremy Scahill for being with us and David Walmsley for making this a conversation that we can all benefit from. Please join me in a round of appreciation for our speakers. Our thanks to the Globe and Mail for making this evening possible, and I'd like to thank our production sponsor, CNW, for that opening video highlighting some of Jeremy's work. Before we go to the cocktail reception, I have a brief CJF commercial. We're proud of the work we're doing, and I'd like to highlight some of that for you. Coming up on May 13th, we're taking the J-Talks to Ottawa. We're joined by a stellar panel of journalists, including Adam Radwanski, Susan Delacourt, and Tom Clark, along with David Hurley and Frank Graves, talking election 2015 and the stories that swing votes. On June 3rd, we're celebrating outstanding Canadian journalistic achievement at the CJF Annual Awards. Peter Mansbridge is our host, and Malcolm Gladwell joins us for a special tribute to his contributions to journalism. Along with our other awards and fellowships, we're proud to recognize crime journalist Michel Auger with the 2015 Lifetime Achievement Award. Michel is arguably one of the most courageous crime reporters in the country over the last century. With his work, he gave readers the fullest possible picture of Montreal's underworld, and he almost died pursuing that truth. On September 13th, 2000, Michel was shot 6 times in the back by an unknown assailant in the parking lot of Le Journal de Montréal. Miraculously, he survived the attack, and he has inspired a generation of Quebec journalists and investigative journalists across the country. We look forward to highlighting his work at the gala. And later this year, British investigative journalist Nick Davies, the Guardian reporter behind the revelations of abuses of power and illegal phone hacking perpetrated by News of the World, joins us for a CJFJ talk in partnership with CBC News. We look forward to seeing you at these events. I'd like to now invite you, along with our audience in the next room, to continue the conversation at the cocktail reception. Jeremy is on hand to meet with you and has kindly offered to sign some of your copies of Dirty Wars. Thank you again for being with us and supporting the work of the Canadian Journalism Foundation.